We live in the world, which is headed and run by the prince of the power of the air. But we live by the Spirit, discerning the times. For he who is spiritual discerns all things. Sharpen your discernment. Build your faith. Listen to the Word and World Team. Minister the Word of God through conversational theology, piercing the darkness of this present evil age.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
Well, welcome. This is Hampton Keithley with Bob Brandon. We are doing our book review on Achilles, The Evolution's Achilles Heels, and today we're going to start chapter 2. You think we'll finish it, Bob?
You know, this is a big one. And we might, you know, depending on how much time we spend summarizing as opposed to reading, though I do want to read a decent amount. This guy's such a good presenter of his material. So this is on genetics. It's so good. But I got some early questions to ask you, Hampton.
Okay.
Number one, are you excited for this?
I am.
Me too. I've been waiting for a long time to get into this. But second, how's your fall weather going? Don't you wish every season of the year was fall?
Yes, I think fall is my favorite. Oh, I was thinking yesterday when it was 90, 92 that I'm ready for some colder weather. And in fact, it's 57 right now, so.
So you got your prayer. It's so pretty in the fall, and the temperatures are just right. I just love it. It's my favorite. Okay. So I was at a swim meet this past weekend, and some thoughts were running through my mind. I constantly lay out for our team members, you know, our swimmers, a little syllogism. Yeah, bring out the whiteboard, scribble some stuff down on there while they're swimming. And my favorite one to put on the board is two sentences. And the first sentence is kind of like a mathematical equation. It says, talent times grit equals a skill. And then I have a second sentence underneath that. And then it says, a skill times grit equals unlimited. So the swimmers are used to thinking, you know, oh, so-and-so is more talented than me. He's a better swimmer, so he's going to beat me. And I always want to remind them, well, in those two equations, talent's in there once, grit is in there twice.
Right.
So grit dominates over time. It's not who's the most talented. Yeah. It's not who's the most talented. It's who's the toughest. Mm-hmm. Will win in any endeavor. You know, you'll see that in life in all sorts of endeavors. So I was thinking, if that's a kind of a universal truth, do we see that in the scriptures? What word would you substitute for grit in the scriptures?
Endurance,
maybe. The way it was running through in my mind was faith.
Yeah.
Right? Like a person times faith equals a Christian. A Christian times faith is unlimited. I mean, don't you have Jesus saying almost exactly that when he curses the fig tree towards the end of his ministry, you know, at the last week of his earthly ministry, and the apostles are just blown away that happened automatically and, you know, so rapidly. which always kind of surprised me, because I'm like, well, you've seen him do some stuff, you know. Why did that one surprise you so much? You've seen him calm the sea, you've seen him raise people from the dead, give sight to the blind. But anyway, that one really surprised him. And so he turns to him and says, you know, if you had faith like a mustard seed, you could say to this mountain, get up and move. And it, and you know, be removed to the sea, and it would. So I think it's faith. You might be right with endurance, but if I was a Christian coach, I would center all my efforts around that idea.
Yeah, that's good.
So, and then I've got another question for you. This is like a tease for somewhere we might go in the future theologically, but I've been reading a good book. You know, one of my favorite things to do in the world is read. There's so, you know, God's put so many good scholars on the earth. Wow. Take advantage of them. You know, read what they're saying. So anyway, this guy pointed, his name, I think, is Michael Morales. I forget where he teaches. But he pointed this out to me in a book. Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible. And structure is way more important, I think, than we've been taught over the years. You know, how the Hebrews write, how Moses writes. It's not just the content, it's the structure is critical to informing the content, right? To pick up their emphases, you got to understand their structure. It's not complicated. You just got to understand it.
You mean like parallelism and chiasm or chiasms?
Those are huge.
Yeah.
And their use of typology is huge. But here's an interesting one. So he wrote the first five books. So the middle book of the five books is Leviticus. And the middle of Leviticus is the Day of Atonement. That can't be by chance. That's structure. I know, isn't it? You know, take two goats, one for Azazel, one for the Lord, right? One to cleanse the holy place, one to send those sins back to the wilderness is the middle of everything Moses had to say. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just whetting our appetite for where we're going to go in the future. Here's 2 Corinthians chapter 10. I'm going to start reading from the NET Bible in verse 3. For though we live as human beings, we do not wage war according to human standards. For the weapons of our warfare are not human weapons, but are made powerful by God for tearing down strongholds. We tear down arguments and every arrogant obstacle that's raised up against the knowledge of God. And we take every thought captive to make it obey Christ. So with that in mind, the dominant paradigm of Western culture, clearly here, at least in the United States, I'd say Europe as well, is evolution. And evolution's a theory of origins. It is not science. And so I want to tear down that argument. We did not evolve. We could not have evolved. I want to tear it down step by step. So this will take us weeks, right? We've already spent a couple weeks on it. This will take us a few more weeks. And with my coaching hat on, I perceive that many believers on this subject punt because they just say, well, yeah, I don't believe in evolution. They know they should say that, right? But they don't really understand why they shouldn't. You shouldn't believe it because God said he created us, number one. But number two, the science doesn't hold. And I want people to understand the science and not punt on that and say, well, I don't have a scientific mind. You know, that's not my background. I don't want people to punt on that. You can understand it. And the more you understand it, the more you will say, that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. That way you'll be, you know, you'll interact more effectively. You won't say to people you're dumb, but you'll be able to explain to them why that's wrong, and not just kind of wrong, could never be the case, kind of wrong.
Yeah.
So guide us through it, Hampton.
Well, his first section is called A Short History of Genetics.
Well, could we back up one sec and say who are we talking about now?
Dr. Robert Carter.
That's right.
Biologist, University of Miami, wrote Genetics, Chapter 2, Genetics and DNA.
There you go.
And then he has his first section called A Short History of Genetics. And, you know, people thought at first that we were just a combination or an average of the two parents, and that, you know, sort of made sense, except
uh-huh.
You think through it, you go, well, eventually, wouldn't we all just look exactly the same, right? We'd all be the same height and,
yeah,
you know, brown eyes and brown hair. And so that's not how it works. And then there was some guy named Lamarck.
Yep.
And he had, it was called Lamarckian inheritance. So he says we change in response to the environment, and then our change gets passed on. So if I worked out really hard and became real strong, then I would pass that on to my kids.
Uh-huh.
So Josiah was such a good swimmer because I worked out.
There you go. And how's Josiah's golf game?
He doesn't do golf. I tried.
So you didn't pass that on.
I didn't pass that on.
Okay. So,
and then I guess Darwin came up with something called pangenesis, but it seemed to me to be the same thing as the Lamarckian idea. He just gave it a different name. Is that a fair assessment?
Yep.
And I found it interesting that he pointed out there that Darwin was not an experimental guy. He never tested his theories. He just would come up with them and then promote it.
There you go.
And so while he's promoting his ideas, this monk named Gregor Mendel was actually doing experiments with white and purple flowers and different seeds. And he's the one who discovered how genes work.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
And as far as you could at that time.
Right. And that's, you know, 1850s, middle of the 1800s. And then you fast forward 100 years to 1953, and that he said Watson and Crick discovered DNA.
Yeah. So, let me pause you there. That's a really interesting story. Watson and Crick. Very interesting. You know what led them to that discovery was actually humility. It's really interesting. We'll go into it at some later time, but that's a fascinating read, the history of how Watson and Crick came up with the right structure for that. But so that the double helix is what they eventually discovered was the structure of a DNA molecule. So like the winding staircase.
That was the history. And then he basically moves on to the next section. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about in that first section?
No, that's good enough to set the table.
And then the next one is DNA as an information storage medium.
Yeah, that one I want to read to some extent. But let's pause and restate that. DNA as an information storage medium. How fascinating. So how about if I read the opening paragraph?
Okay.
Hey, let me try a joke out on you before I read this.
Is this a Quinn joke?
No. Okay. Quinn's in college now.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
My joke source is gone. Okay. I forget where I saw this, but Hampton, never trust an atom.
Never trust an atom.
Yeah, they make up everything. Okay.
That sounds like a twin joke.
Okay. So here we go. DNA as an information storage medium. All life. That's what, as soon as I saw those words, that joke popped into my mind. Okay. All life depends on specific information, an instruction set, as it were, to survive and reproduce. Let's pause there. Is that how you typically think of life, as ultimately dependent on information?
No.
I don't think most people look at it that way, but that is true. Ponder that. It's really interesting. Much of that information is coded in DNA, a molecule which is unsurpassed as an information storage medium. One can put an amazing number of instructions in just a tiny bit of DNA. Think of a printed page. Each letter on the page may be 3 or 4 millimeters high. There are several thousand letters on a standard page of text. If we printed out the human genome as a text and bound it into Bible-sized books, it would take 850 Bibles to hold it. And since you inherit one copy from your mother and the other from your father, you hold two copies of the genome in each cell in your body, minus red blood cells. They don't have nuclei. The letters of DNA, however, are only a few billionths of a meter tall. At that size, all 3 billion letters could easily fit inside something much smaller than the period at the end of this sentence. In the cell, they are strung together in chains, that is, chromosomes, that, if lined up from end to end, would be about 2 meters long. Those long, fragile, sticky strings are packed into a nucleus only 6 to 10 millionths of a meter in diameter. The entire instruction set for building and maintaining a person is rooted in something so small you cannot see it without a microscope. So just pause there for a second. That's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
I think you could spend the rest of your life pondering that and never get bored. And one of the conclusions you would reach after a couple seconds is there's no way that could happen by chance.
Right.
Right? Something that loaded with information in the size of something that you need a microscope to see. There's no way that could happen by random chance.
No way.
Well,
and he points out, I think, in this, his point in this chapter is that the origin of all that information is a huge problem, but that's not what he's talking about in this chapter. He's talking about the maintenance and the mutations of that.
Correct. So let me just read the last sentence of the next paragraph, and then the last paragraph, then we'll move on to the next section, because you're right. So he's going through the numbers of, let me set it up a little bit. Yet those chains, so he's referring to the chromosomes, are not very stable. Single-stranded DNA is liable to break. In the nucleus, each strand is paired with a complementary strand, and the two twist around each other to form the classic double helix shape. A piece of DNA is actually two separate but complementary molecules glued together by electrostatic interactions. The 3 billion DNA letters in the human genome are found in 23 separate chromosomes, ranging from about 50 million to about 250 million letters in length. Even in this configuration, however, DNA is not very stable. it's still super sensitive to degradation, and it's estimated there are up to 1 million DNA lesions. That's like a break, right? Some sort of damage or some destruction in a normal cell every day. Is that staggering?
Yes.
1 million mutations per day in every cell. Okay. In a normal cell every day. Imagine the effort a single cell must go through daily to maintain its complement of DNA. So it's fixing that stuff all the time. Right. Now multiply that effort. What's 1 million times, you know, the number? I don't even know the name for the next number he printed.
100 quintillion.
Okay. So 1 million times 100 quintillion. That's what it takes to keep your genome working in your body on a daily basis. So I know it's painstaking in some sense to read this, you know, sentence for sentence, but you almost need to impress on people how complex this stuff is, because the more you realize that fact, the more you're going to say, there's no way that could happen by chance. And when I say no way, I don't mean like, nah, 1 in 100. There is zero chance that could happen by chance.
Yeah.
Right? So we didn't evolve. But let's read on. DNA fragility is one of many, and here's the title of the book, Achilles' Heels for Evolutionary Genetics. But it's an important one. In order for DNA to be useful, it needs a huge complement of repair enzymes to maintain it. There are many different ways DNA can be damaged. There are specific enzyme complexes that deal with each type of damage. But what's even more challenging to the evolutionary model is that those enzymes are also coded in the DNA. Yet DNA cannot be sustained in the cell without them. This is a chicken and egg problem par excellence. Do you understand that point?
Yeah.
Right? So it breaks down 1 million times a day in each cell of your body. So it's got to be constantly repaired. And it is. But those repairs come from the DNA itself. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like Behe's mousetrap. It's either all there and working, or it's not working. You can't evolve a system like that step by step. It has to be all there at once. You couldn't have one thing without the other. Let me say it again. We did not evolve. Could not have. So let me finish out this paragraph. These enzymes are also sensitive to changes. Mutations in the DNA repair and copying enzymes are often catastrophic. How then did they originate? Through the process of mutation and natural selection over time. Without them, life cannot exist. Yet life had to originate without them and had to start using DNA to store information before the DNA toolkit evolved. Since this will be dealt with more in depth in the next chapter on the origin of life, let it suffice to say that DNA is the last thing one would ever expect early life to start using for information storage. Yeah. Yet it did. Okay, so any comments?
No.
Okay, the next section is DNA and information theory. Anything to point out there, Hampton, in your thinking?
Well, the second paragraph, information maintenance is another Achilles heel.
Yeah. Very, very similar to what we just read.
Kind of the same.
Okay. So the next section.
I thought it was interesting. He points out that a female fetus develops all the eggs that the woman will ever have.
Right away.
Early in the process of development.
Yeah.
And so that is a way of slowing down the mutation process so that she might be 30 years old and have gone through all these mutations, but the eggs that get fertilized were developed 30 years earlier, and so they don't have all those mutations.
Okay,
and then a young man has less mutations to pass on than an old man.
Yep. Yeah, so Isaac, he was really bucking the trend, right? Yeah. Abraham was an old guy.
Yeah.
So, you know, he points out, this is kind of interesting, another way to look at life. When you see a pregnant woman, you're actually looking at three generations.
Yeah.
Right? There's the mom who's pregnant. There's the baby inside. And then there's the future baby inside the baby. You really, really look at it, right? The grandchild's in there too.
Right.
It's kind of interesting. Okay. Next section, junk DNA is mostly functional. So we've heard that for the last few decades, right? That, most of our genome is junk DNA. I've never been so insulted when I heard that. You know, like, yeah. Come on, God doesn't make stuff. You know, why would you make stuff that is junk? You know, the implication is it's non-functional. You can throw it away. It doesn't do anything. Yeah, the instant I heard that.
He makes a comment in here of that. What's the biology's, one of their axioms is form follows function.
Yeah.
So if it exists, it's got a function. And I used to think that the appendix was unnecessary the consoles.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember just the first time I ever heard that, just going, you're going to regret that statement so much. I mean, you're going to find out, it is functional. Yeah. So let's read this section. We've heard the old canard for decades. It goes something like only 2-3% of the human genome is functional. The rest is worthless junk DNA, garbage left over from our evolutionary heritage. You've almost never heard a dumber statement in biology. And yet many people repeated that.
Yeah.
Right? It's completely wrong. Although this is still a commonly held belief, recent discoveries have shown it to be wrong. Why then have we heard about it so often and for so long? Just pause there before we... Why? Why did they keep saying that when it was just dead wrong? Because it fits a evolutionary model.
Yeah.
Right? Right? So,
a great mathematical problem.
Yes, it's because biological evolution needs junk DNA to solve a great mathematical problem. And then he goes into all that detail. I don't think we need to read that, but that stuff is not, it is functional. It's not junk. It's very functional. And we'll read on to see how it does what it does. But here's a final quote. In that section, and it's from an evolutionary biologist, and he says this: the failure to recognize the full implications of this, particularly the possibility that the intervening non-coding sequences may be transmitting parallel information in the form of RNA molecules, may well go down as one of the biggest mistakes in the history of molecular biology. So even the evolutionary guys now go, that was, we were wrong about that.
Well, they don't point out in that section that it was the Human Genome Project where they mapped the DNA that they discovered that it was mostly functional.
Yeah. Yeah. So next one I want to read, next section, Hampton, if you'll bear with me, I want to read this in detail.
Okay.
Okay. And we'll pause and talk about it, but this is so important. So this section is called Ultra Complex Gene Processing. Biology students of the past were always taught the one gene, one enzyme hypothesis. I was taught that. Based on the amazing discoveries over the course of the 20th century, it seemed a straightforward conclusion that a gene was a piece of DNA that coded for a specific protein. A gene had specific starting and ending points, sections that coded for protein. Another name for that is exons. Perhaps a few intervening sequences, introns, that needed to be cut out of the primary RNA transcript before translating the gene into a protein, and upstream and downstream regulatory areas where things could bind to the DNA and control the expression of the gene. It was easy to walk through a gene and see these places. One could even translate the DNA into protein on the fly from the sequence of the messenger RNA strand if one knew the three-letter codes for each amino acid. And that's not hard to do that. There's a grave problem with the one gene, one enzyme hypothesis, however. For like Darwin's idea of pangenesis and the existence of junk DNA, it's also wrong. From the results of the ENCODE project specifically, so ENCODE, all capital letters, right? So it's an acronym for the next project they did after the Human Genome Project. The world has been given a glimpse inside the most sophisticated computer operating system in the known universe, the human genome. But it's not a protein computer. Actually, the genome is more like an RNA supercomputer that outputs protein. In a similar way to your computer, which has a hard drive, rewritable memory, that's RAM, and a screen for output, the genomic computer has DNA for information storage, RNA for information comparison and calculation, and protein for output.
I can't help but think about, you know, this whole vaccine thing and the ability of these people to go into the RNA and send the message and develop the spike protein. And so, you know, all of that is, you know, embedded in this, what we're talking about.
It is. And you can guess that's going to go horribly wrong, because this is so much more complex than just changing out some of that RNA, right? You can just see that they've been wrong on this stuff every time. They're going to be wrong again. That's going to create major problems in the body. But you're exactly right. This is
important. I mean, just thinking about, as a computer programmer, if I go in and think I'm tweaking something, I'm going to make it, you know, solve some problem on my website, and then I go and test it and it breaks.
Yeah. And you created three more problems, right?
Right.
You know, by feeling, that's exactly right. Unintended consequences. It's been so common in history. I mean, I can't believe people are falling for that. Hey, honestly. But here, you need this info. This will inform your decisions on that stuff. And by the way, I recommend people get the book, because it's got, you know, some illustrations. So while you're reading, or I'm reading, you know, over the podcast, people don't have this picture necessarily in their mind that he has up above what he's writing. So he has like a diagram of a computer program, Linux. And then he has next to it, just from a bacteria, E. coli, a genetic section. And you can see how similar those things are. Yet you can see how different they are. You know, very similar, but very different. Like one of them way more complex than the other one. But some of the similar.
Yeah, and one of the comparisons he makes is that when we have an error in our programming code, it crashes the system. And yet this, the genome computer doesn't crash. It's got all these error correction things that are, you know, keep it going.
There, I mean, imagine just the complexity of that, that you can handle mutations. God has built a thing that's able to handle mistakes and not crash. It's just, again, mind-blowing. And again, it could not have happened by chance. But let's read on. Efforts have been made to compare genome control processes to human-designed computer systems. That's a healthy comparison. That's good to do that. The parallels are interesting, but the differences are striking. For example, when compared to the computer operating system, Linux, the E. coli bacterial genome has fewer high-level regulators, which in turn control fewer middle-level managers, which in turn control many more lower-level outputs. It's as if its genome is optimized to do what it does as efficiently as possible. Instead of Linux, a better comparison might be to military computers, which typically have very short programs with minimal instructions. This is true because they're designed to do a limited set of things as efficiently as possible, instead of many different things at once. Yet, here's another puzzle. It took us many man hours to design the computers that fly B-52 bombers. Did you ever fly one of those, Hampton?
No, I was stationed at Fairchild Air Force Base, and we had B-52s on that.
Okay. So he goes, here's another puzzle. It took us many man hours to design the computers that fly B-52 bombers, yet a single error in any program of any subsystem can cause catastrophic failure of the system it's controlling. The human genome is far more complex and can withstand thousands of errors without crashing. It controls more things simultaneously and is better designed. So how do you get better designed than the greatest human minds on earth? You couldn't do that by chance. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You could. I know I keep repeating that.
Well, I know when I'm reading this book, I'm just over and over, I'm like, how can people believe in evolution?
It did not happen, could not happen, flat out, according to the science.
Right.
Remember some of our core principles, right? That there's good science and there's bad science. Science is done by human beings. So there's errors in there. Human beings have worldviews. The first thing a human being will do for his worldview is lie. So there's bad science. But there's also good science. So we're reading some of that right now. One more paragraph. When the human genome was completed, researchers were shocked to find only about 23,000 genes in the genome. Keep that in mind. Shocked to find that. That what he means is that there were so few.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We already knew that the number of proteins the human body produces is many more times than this. How could this be? If one gene codes for one protein, but you've only got 23,000 genes and zillions of proteins, how's that work? Well, maybe some of those assumptions were wrong. So a few years later, the ENCODE project gave us strong hints that the human genome has a huge amount of alternate splicing. Each part of a gene, we have learned, can be used in multiple different proteins. That's what I mean, Hampton. I'm sorry I'm interrupting myself here, but that what you brought up, that, you know, mRNA or the RNA vaccine, that's going to have unintended consequences, right? You can't, it's not a simple replace this gene with this code. Those things make multiple proteins.
Right.
And it even gets more complex than that, as we'll see. But anyway, there's going to be unseen consequences there.
Well, I thought in a programming world, there's inline linear programs where you do lots of if else, and if this happens, do this, else do that. And then more advanced programming is called object-oriented programming. And so you have your little modules, and you can call this module from many different parts of the program. And so that's why when you're using your computer, all of your applications, when you go file open, you know, they all pretty much do the same, looks the same, because they're all calling the same module. So it's a similar type of thing, I think.
Yeah, there we go. So, you know, one summary, he's going to point this out later. You know, our computer codes are 2D, DNA is 4D.
Yeah.
Imagine that. So let's keep reading. Somehow the body knows how to create different combinations of what were thought to be distinct protein coding genes and splice them together to create several hundred thousand unique proteins. Not only that, but different cell types can create different proteins from that complicated process. Not only that, but different proteins are produced at different times. And somehow the cells know what to produce, when to produce it, and under which conditions. There's something controlling this process, and it's not necessarily in the protein coding portion of the genome. So another way, you know, to express in writing, right, in narrative, unbelievable molecular complexity. That's all working efficiently in your body, or you wouldn't be here. You'd just drop over. You'd cease to function. Embedded within each gene is a series of small codes. Each is only a few letters long, but there are multiple codes at the beginning and end of each exon and intron. They make up what has been called the spliceosome. That is the part of the genome that controls the complicated process of exon recombination or gene splicing. The complexity of the spliceosome, indeed the complexity of the entire genome of all eukaryotes, that's everything above a bacteria, is yet another Achilles heel of evolutionary genetics. The genome is too complicated, and the target for mutations is much too large for known species to survive for millions of years, let alone for them to have evolved in the first place. So there's our author. Let me refer back to his name. What was that? Dr. Robert Carter. There's him saying, no way.
Mm-hmm.
That complexity is just so vast that there's no way that could entail evolution. You may be wondering why I have put the word gene in quote marks, because throughout, you know, quote marks throughout this chapter, it's because we have no longer have a definition of the word. That's how complex it is you can't, they don't even have a word now to describe that whole thing. at least the definition has changed to mean something entirely new for all organisms more complex than bacteria. Genetics has taken a turn toward complexity, and the simple old idea has become outmoded. From here on out, when the word gene appears, take it in the classical sense. A gene is a piece of DNA that codes for a protein. The only problem with this definition is that any particular piece of DNA might be used in multiple proteins, depending on the context. So that finishes that section. So what you've got is, you know, the takeaway is, I wish I had the right vocabulary for it, Hampton, but it's, well, I mean, it's exponential complexity.
Yeah.
Vastly complex. That's the main point of that. But he's gone into the detail to prove that point. Then the next section is, I'm not going to read it word for word. It's just the hyper complexity of a four-dimensional genome. It's just mind blowing.
Yeah.
Right. But I did want to read the last.
You mentioned what you said earlier about two-dimensional versus.
Yeah. 4D. Yeah. So I'm just going to read the last paragraph of that section, not the whole section. The point he's driving at is the hyper complexity of a four-dimensional genome. So this is all extremely complicated. He's gone through, you know, the 4D aspects. But it underscores the next Achilles heel of evolutionary genetics. Darwinism needs life to be simple. Natural selection needs the ability to take the little tweaks caused by mutation and select the best from a herd or a group of animals. Once a species is in existence, perhaps natural selection could work in limited ways. But can this process explain how the species came into existence in the first place? So remember, evolution is a theory of origins.
Right.
It's not science. The whole goal is to eliminate God from creation. I'm not over-exaggerating that. That is the goal. So evolution's grand purpose is to explain how we got here apart from God. Well, we didn't get here apart from God. So the whole thing crashes. It cannot explain the existence of a single bacteria. But here's his answer. Again, let me state his question. But can this process explain how the species came into existence in the first place? Hardly. For a simple process of error accumulation and selection could not create a complex, interleaved, four-dimensional system with an amazing amount of data compression and flexibility. And once that system's in place, it'll be seriously threatened by future random changes through mutation. That's the situation we're in today. It's fine to imagine small changes to an already existing complex system. To use those small changes as an explanation for the origin of that system itself, however, is tantamount to saying there was no intelligence involved in the production of the latest computer operating systems. Yet the genome far surpasses in complexity and efficiency an operating system in the world today. Any operating system in the world. So let me put it in street language, because I'm a street guy, Hampton.
Okay.
So imagine, you know, your laptop, and somebody came up and, you know, said, "Well, where'd you get that?" Oh, well, this came about over millions of years. You know, there was some wind. There's some electromagnetic properties in this computer. There's some atoms and, you know, polarity. And it just came about. It just happened. This is purely natural. I just walked outside and there it was. Nobody made it. It just, you know, the natural world made it.
The old saying is that about the blind watchmaker, you know.
That, yeah, that's what I'm just saying that in a different way.
That watch is simple compared to what we're learning about the DNA.
Yeah, unbelievably simple compared to DNA, right? Everything in the universe is unbelievably simple compared to the human genome. And you're going to tell people that came about by random processes? There was no designer? That just happened over time? It's impossible. That's what I mean. You know, I know it's, I don't want to sound like a jerk, but that's what I mean when I say you would be so dumb to believe that. You would be so gullible. And yet human beings aren't dumb and gullible generally. It's their worldview that makes them that way.
Yeah. Well, right? So back to our saying for the year. It's easier to fool someone than for them to admit that they were fooled.
There you go. So once you've bought that, once you've bought this line of bull, there is no God, will you believe anything? And that's not an exaggeration either. You will believe anything once you disbelieve that there's a God. I mean, you'll believe there's not really a distinction between boys and girls. You'll believe there are 20 some genders. You know what I mean? You will be an idiot.
Right.
Once you...
So. Yeah, Chesterton, I like his quote where he says, they tried to pull the miter off of pontifical man and his head came off with it.
Right. Right. So we still got a fair amount in this chapter. Do you want to keep going or should we, how are we time-wise?
Well, we've been going on about almost an hour, but...
What did you want to hit?
Codon degeneracy. I don't have anything highlighted in that section.
Okay, me neither.
And then multiple overlapping codes.
Yeah, I have that whole thing underlined. Yeah. But it's just pointing, you know, we can summarize it. It's just further complexity.
Yeah, I just have the last part. It says, how could a simple process of trial and error, always seeking the simplest answer to an environmental problem, create an interleaved and multi-layered system of regulation? In fact, the system is one of the wonders of the universe. Without this level of multitasking, the genome would have to be much larger, and it might not be possible for DNA-based multicellular organisms to exist at all without it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's... And you know what? I want to make this point. I'm sure what our author in this chapter is saying is not even beginning to describe the complexity. I'll bet you they'll find out it's even more complex than what he's saying in the future, right? And that was the basic idea behind Behe's title of Darwin's Black Box. The more you open up the scientific realm, the more evolution is absurd.
Right. Well, I think that the evidence for genesis in our genes is probably a very important section. So we should probably stop now and do that next time.
Okay. Because then next time, what we'll cover also, which is fun, is, you know, don't people commonly hear, oh, the Neanderthal. Right? Mm-hmm. The missing link between apes and humans. No. Right? We'll get to that. And then we'll get to the differences between chimps, our biologically closest species, and us. And the difference is just dramatic. But we can cover all those next time. That'd be good.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, I will talk to you next time.
Thanks, Hampton. Bye-bye.
Therefore, I exhort you, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a sacrifice, alive, holy, and pleasing to God, which is your reasonable service. Do not be conformed to this present world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may test and approve what is the will of God, what is good and well-pleasing and perfect.